This week on Behind the Lens, the City of New Orleans considers new regulations on short-term rentals. We'll get a recap from the City Council debate. While the planet's climate changes, the political climate in Louisiana remains as is. We'll hear one reporter's account and a win for the Lens at the State Supreme Court. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
It's widely acknowledged that short-term home rentals through Airbnb and similar companies are changing the fabric of many city neighborhoods. Now, New Orleans council members are considering big changes to how the city regulates the practice. Charles Maldonado has details.
We have to go back to go back a few years. So the issue of the proliferation of short-term rentals had been coming up a lot in the Landrieu administration. Short-term rentals at the time were illegal, but they were still happening. They were all over the place in the city. So the city decided to develop a regulatory structure. And in 2016, they passed a law legalizing short-term rentals, creating licenses for them. The problem, as many people saw it, was the law that was created at the time was too lax, and it tended to favor the further proliferation of short-term rentals throughout the city. You know, there were no caps on short-term rentals, you know, per block caps or citywide caps or anything like that. The types of things that had been called for initially, and a specific area of concern was always the whole home rentals in residential neighborhoods. So people, you know, buying a house, using it strictly as a short-term rental. The first regulatory structure placed a cap on that sort of use at 90 days per year. But even at 90 days per year, you know, even for the people who were staying within that limit, which was not everybody, that's still like every weekend night per year, or, you know, as a block, 3 months a year. It would make it difficult for a full-time renter to be in that property. Last year in May, right after the new council took office, one of the first things they did was put a temporary moratorium on the most popular type of rental licenses, which was the whole home residential license. Okay. And that applied to the neighborhoods where they were the most popular, basically, you know, historic core neighborhoods in the city. Right. And they also instituted a study with a goal of further restricting short-term rentals to be done by the City Planning Commission.
Okay.
That commission study came out. It recommended really pulling back on short-term rentals in a lot of different ways. From that, Councilwoman Kristen Palmer, who represents District C, which includes downriver neighborhoods like Marigny and Bywater, where short-term rentals have been very popular. She's been leading this charge. She developed her own plan based on that proposal. It more or less followed it in a lot of ways. In other ways, it kind of watered down some of the City Planning Commission recommendations. And now, after council negotiations, we get to this plan that was voted on yesterday, which is largely based on Kristen Palmer's proposal, but has been kind of further watered down in certain areas.
Okay. So presented at City Council Thursday for public comment. What are some of the highlights of this plan at this point?
So the big news that comes out of this plan, right, is that it's going to change. It's going to fundamentally change these whole home licenses in residential neighborhoods, effectively banning them. Now, the current structure allows you to rent out an entire house 90 days a year. You don't have to be on site. You don't have to live there. What this is going to do is say, we're going to create a new type of license. You have to have a homestead exemption at the property where you're going to be renting it out. So you have to prove that you actually live there. You have to be on site when you have guests in the property. So on the other side of it, you're allowed to have three of these licenses per property. So say you live in a fourplex with three rental units, you could have short-term rental licenses on the three other units. Or, you know, you live in a double, you could have a short-term rental license on the other side of your house. But you have to live in one side of that house. In commercial districts, there's one category that will be changed significantly. That's for single-family, single-unit properties in commercial districts. So we're talking condos and single-family houses that happen to be in commercial and mixed-use districts. Those, like the residential district licenses, will require a homestead exemption. For other types of properties in commercial districts, right now it is going to be largely the same as the current regulatory structure.
And we expected this to have a full-throated public comment period. It certainly did. What were some of the concerns raised by members of the public on either side of the debate?
Yeah, when you boil it down, we have one side that is concerned that, you know, the people who have been skeptical of short-term rentals are happy about this, generally speaking, but they're still concerned that this allows for too many short-term rentals to exist and that there is no specific affordability component of this yet. They're also concerned that there isn't enough to force short-term rental platforms like Airbnb to comply with city laws. People on that side have been calling for better data sharing from the platforms. They've been calling for the platforms to have licenses themselves. Now, in a separate motion yesterday, the city council voted to have the executive branch develop a series of proposals to beef up enforcement and deal with these platform problems. So that's on one side. On the other side, the concern, and this was shared by some council members yesterday, the concern was that people have been making investments based on the regulatory structure that was developed in 2016, which includes these whole home rentals. Now they've sunk money into properties, and those properties will no longer be legal for the use they intended for them. You know, that side of this is saying this is a legitimate source of income in a city that's become more and more expensive. This is helping people pay their mortgages. This is helping people get by. And now people have sunk money into it, and that money is all going to go to waste. So the council is concerned about that. And I think that's going to continue to come up over the next couple of months as this goes through the process.
Okay, and what is that process now? Where does this proposal go from here?
So this goes to the City Planning Commission. The City Planning Commission has to make a series of recommendations based on the guidelines the council has set. Then it goes back to the council where it faces a few more votes before it can be put into law. So we're going to see a lot more debate on this in the coming months. This isn't expected to be done until the spring.
Charles Maldonado, editor at The Lens, thank you very much for covering this.
Thank you, Tom.
The last year came to a close with ample warnings about the state of the global environment. Climate change is already impacting Louisiana communities in the severity of extreme weather events, by coastal erosion, and more. And recent years have taught us painful lessons about our vulnerabilities to these changes. But are state politicians getting the message? We spoke with journalist Julie Domanski about her reporting for DSMOG on the political environment.
The big focus in this piece was, like I said, the political environment in Louisiana, in part how the political establishment has reacted to this most recent national climate assessment. In a nutshell, what was your general takeaway on the political reaction or the lack thereof, taking from your writing there?
Well, the lack thereof reaction from that climate assessment it reflects the part of the problem in Louisiana. If you deny there's a problem, you can go on with destructive behavior. And that's exactly what you see happening in the state. I mean, there's a complete climate denial problem in the state. Maybe there are one or two politicians that might say something about man's role, but in general, it's the notion that man is impacting the climate, but we don't know how much, and it's really, because you can't prove exactly how much, it's really not an issue. And so, you know, it's like a green light not to pay attention to the National Climate Assessment that was, you know, so many scientists from around the world contributed a report after report saying that this is an emergency and that if we don't do something, life on planet Earth could become unsustainable in not too long a time.
And you reached out to the governor's office for their reaction to the climate assessment. And
yes, I periodically check in with his press secretary to ask if he would like to update the stance he made in 2016 on his radio show, because I'm aware that politicians evolve in their thinking. So I'd never want to just re-quote something from a couple years back. And with the mounting scientific reporting and assessments like that one and others, I wanted to give him a chance to weigh in.
And did you get a response from the governor's office?
I did not.
And you wrote that, and you still have not gotten a response.
No, and usually I add in and I say, you know, this is ongoing reporting, so whenever there is a change, I don't think I had that in this last request. But I did get an answer I'd have to look at the exact date, but saying that he stood by his comments at some point last year.
Okay.
But not for this newest one after the assessment.
And what about the congressional delegation? You note that there had not seemed to be any mention of the assessments on their web pages.
There is none. Yeah, right. You can go and check that. I don't think it's changed since my article. But you know, that's one way to tell what a politician's concerns are, is just to go to their web page or their Twitter feed, or, you know, but there's nothing on their webpage about addressing this issue.
Sure. Do you mind if we talk a little bit about the assessment and some of the things it covered? Would you be comfortable, at least not getting too technically grounded? I just want to sort of inquire about some of the vulnerabilities that the assessment had to address with southeastern cities, for instance, like New Orleans. I mean, are there? Sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically coastal erosion, the extreme weather, which comes with flooding and destruction. And, you know, as the temperature raises, you can have different diseases set in. From bugs, insects, I mean, and, you know, other invasive species that are suddenly able to adapt and live with hotter weather than the natural species in the area. Stuff like that is in the report. And, you know, stuff like that you can see if you're a reporter in the area and you go out. You know, you can watch the changes. And I don't know if it specifically dealt with toxic algae, but that's something that I'm watching for, having covered the blue-green algae and the red tide events in Florida and the Gulf last year. We have issues of not so much red tide, but blue-green algae in Lake Pontchartrain. And, you know, that could start getting worse for sure. So stuff like that.
Does that represent a potential public health a threat?
Oh, absolutely. Hands down. There are reports that show it could bring on Alzheimer's. It's serious stuff. It's incredibly toxic. And it gets airborne. It's not just water pollution.
Certainly the assessment had a lot to say with regard to rising sea levels, extreme rain events, and how those contribute to coastal flooding across the wide span of the Southeast where we have come in and built. Some of these regions are in fact still hosting significant economic development. You wrote about Plaquemines Parish, for instance.
Oh yeah, well, Plaquemines Parish, and right now, just tomorrow on Tuesday, the 8th, the board, the Port Authority in Manchac will be voting on letting a housing development build about, I think it's about 200 units, just right in the stretch of land that is separated by one road that goes between Manchac and Pontchartrain. It's absolutely insane. And this is being considered despite all of that. So it's like an ongoing disaster you can watch in Louisiana of things moving in the wrong direction, of things like a natural gas power plant being proposed in Plaquemines Parish that still is short of permits being given, but that the governor has wholesale endorsed before permits are given. You know, it seems like every project is welcome, and let alone you have the air pollution that it puts out and how it impacts climate change on the one hand, and on the other hand, just the mere existence of power plants and other plastic-making facilities, factories in flood zones, which can get flooded and pollute in the way, that way, not just in production, but just from being flooded.
Right.
Shows a lack of regard for our current reality.
And we certainly saw some of the implications of that industrial waste as a factor in catastrophes like Hurricane Katrina, certainly.
Well, and Isaac as well. Plaquemines Parish got hit, and there were train cars turned over in Plaquemines Parish that polluted a community.
Right. Houston, certainly last year with a devastating hurricane there.
Yeah, Harvey, and then you have to consider, you know, with a 1,000-year flood, as well as with Harvey, what do you do with the waste from even people's homes? And where do you put it? And it often ends up in African-American communities. They put the toxic dumps right next to those communities often. So it's like a cascade of pollution problems.
Right. Well, we just had a 1,000-year flood 2 years ago. In
2016,
And the climate is the NCA put the total cost of just the 2016 flooding alone at $10.1 billion. Now we hear language used a lot about a 1,000-year flood, as you say, or 100-year floods. Should these labels serve to reassure people whatsoever, or do we, generally speaking, need to be expecting more of this sort of extreme weather in coming years?
I think those classifications need to be updated. I think scientists are looking at old data. I'm not sure exactly how they do it, but it's basically how it assesses different factors coming together at the same time.
Sure.
And how it will impact. But yeah, clearly they seem wildly off, you know,
right.
When you get that, you know, but they have their own basis for that. But you can just expect that you're going to get much more flooding and extreme, that it's not going to be an anomaly. It's more the norm.
Right.
And that no one is safe. I mean, anyone in Louisiana who doesn't have flood insurance because they're not in a quote-unquote flood zone is really gambling, is my personal take.
Are there specific things that you see other states implementing, doing, that Louisiana should consider doing also in terms of preparing residents and businesses better for climate change?
You know, I think some of this idea of resiliency is talking points, and consultants are being paid. If 40 inches of rain come down in 2 days, God help you. I mean, well, you know, how can you be prepared for that except for to have been ready to clear out before it actually comes down? So the only thing I see that other areas are doing are some are turning away from the fossil fuel industry and not green lighting every new project coming in. But as far as protecting yourself from the changes that have already happened, there's lots of talk. There's lots of plans for projects that then get derailed. I know in Manhattan there are all kinds of projects about seawalls similar to our master plan for protecting the coast, but they take so many years to implement. So who knows if they'll be in time as things, you know, continue to worsen. So I don't think there's too much you can do, really. You know, do you have your go bag ready? You know where right. your car title is.
Right.
If you were to offer some tips for news consumers to be able to keep up with this sort of activity and those efforts to stem the tide, if you will, what would you offer in terms of suggestions?
People like to take pot shots at the media, but the media is like a big thing. You know, that's like saying all politicians sure. are horrible or whatever. I'd say that if you're not convinced you're getting the full story on something like climate change, look for independent media sources like DSmog, which is where most of my stories are published on DSmog, and there's The Intercept, and locally, The Lens. And, you know, everyone has to take it upon themselves to question who's behind the report. So if it's CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox, who owns them? And you can Google that.
You can
Google
that, yes. And then
you get your answers. So instead of blaming the media or saying all media sucks, there still is a healthy but small contingent of independent news sources and independent reporters, and find them and support them, follow them on social media, share their work, and dig deeper. You know, don't take what you're hearing on, you know, corporate-owned TV station and think you've got the gospel of truth.
Julie Domanski reports at dsmogblog.com. That's dsmogblog.com. The South Tangipahoa Parish Port Commission, by the way, which oversees Port Manchac, they approved further studies on that development project that Julie mentioned in our discussion. The Louisiana Supreme Court has handed the New Orleans District Attorney's Office another loss in its battle against this news organization. D.A. Leon Canizero wanted the justices to reconsider lower court rulings on our request for records linked to the infamous fake subpoenas practice. The High Court declined. We got a recap from Attorney Scott Sternberg, representing the Lens in this case.
Scott, briefly, what exactly was involved in this case? It kicked off with an April 2017 public records request from this news organization.
Right. I mean, it actually kicked off before then, because at some point, our reporter, Charles Maldonado, who's now the editor of The Lens, got a tip from someone that there was a fake subpoena in the files of a criminal district court. So he went down there and he used his constitutional right of access and he accessed the record. He looks at the record and it just doesn't look right, because it's a district attorney subpoena, and subpoenas are normally signed by a judge. So he's trying to figure out what's going on, particularly because this case was State versus Cardell Hayes, which of course was a very famous criminal matter involving the death of Will Smith, the Saints player. So on that DA subpoena, it says that a fine or imprisonment may be imposed for failure to obey this notice. And whenever you see something like fine or imprisonment, it raises your antenna as a reporter.
It appears to be an official document and an official warning.
Right. It does. And the issue with the subpoena was that it was not signed by a judge. And, of course, the Code of Criminal Procedure requires a subpoena to a third party that's not the accused, someone who is, for example, a witness, to be given a subpoena by a judge or even a clerk sometimes in many cases. And I'm not a criminal lawyer, but I've kind of learned a little bit about this over the last 2 years, and that just didn't sit right. So Charles writes a story and issues a public records request to the district attorney, and he says, I want to see all of these DA subpoenas from your files for a certain period of time. And we thought it was a pretty narrow amount of time. He asked for any and all DA subpoenas beginning January 1, 2016 through April 27th of 2017. So, you know, only about 16 months.
The DA's reaction to that was?
Well, the DA's reaction was to do absolutely nothing. Eventually denied the request as unduly burdensome, which is it's not really an exception to the public records law, but there's a lot of case law that says that it is. They said it was too difficult to locate a year and a half's worth of DA subpoenas because of the way that they maintained their files.
Which venue initially heard this case, the Orleans Parish Civil
District Court? So we filed suit shortly after in May. And right after we filed suit, the DA's lawyer gave us a call and said, hey, let's talk, you know, let's see if we can work this out. That happens a lot, you know, litigation settles all the time. So we go and talk to them and they talk to us about their record keeping process. And we say, we understand that your record keeping is difficult. We want to see the DA subpoenas. While this is going on, there is a national story and a national conversation going on about what the district attorney is doing with these so-called fake subpoenas. So we have other interest groups that have also filed their own lawsuits who are also trying to find these fake subpoenas. In the meantime, the Lens goes out and sends like 2,000 postcards to just random people to see if you have been served with one of these fake subpoenas. At one point, they find somebody who's been served with a fake subpoena who thought it was a real subpoena. Fascinating stuff.
You were able to push this through the court system in terms of win after win. What was your basic argument for getting these what we maintained all along were public records?
Well, it's kind of a nuanced issue because we made a couple of other requests at the DA's suggestion to narrow the request. We're trying to work with the DA and get the documents without having to proceed on the lawsuit. Eventually, we wound up having to proceed on the lawsuit, and we filed a first amended petition where we included all those new requests that we made kind of at their urging. And what happened was is we went before the trial judge, Judge Kern Reese, and Judge Reese ruled that the district attorney subpoenas, which were in the closed files, so the files that were no longer in active criminal litigation, like there was no longer the threat of criminal jeopardy as to the accused, had to be turned over. And the district attorney started producing those subpoenas until we went to a status conference with the judge. And the judge was not thrilled with the timing. He wanted them to move faster on producing the subpoenas. And the next day, or actually the same day, they took a suspensive appeal, which means that they no longer had to comply with the order because they were going to appeal the case.
Okay.
So they appealed the case. And we had to deal with the appeals court after that.
Finally, this makes its way to the state Supreme Court, which says we will not reconsider the issue. We get a statement. We did ask for a statement from the district attorney's office. Here's part of that statement from DA's spokesman, Ken Daly. Our office never has had anything to hide in regard to such stylized documents. Our objection before the courts was against the onerous expense and hardship that a hand search to fulfill such an excessively broad request would entail. Ultimately, more than 4,000 man hours were expended by more than 100 OPDA employees to search for such documents among an estimated 50,000 electronic case files and 1,766 crates of closed case files. Scott, clearly Ken Daly here is writing to the task of fulfilling these public records requests by the lens. Do you have any response to that level of work that is being requested here?
I have no doubt that they had to put in a lot of work here. The way the district attorney keeps its files, the way they testified as to how they keep their files, sounds like it was a very cumbersome process. But there were also a lot of things at the trial that we heard that they didn't do. They never sent out an email to all the district attorneys and said, have you sent one of these DA subpoenas? And to me, that would have seemed like a pretty easy way to just find out if it had been sent. Because at the trial, they testified that these were extremely rare and that it was a notable occurrence. And so in my mind, an email would have been the first step. But they did have to review every file. And, you know, sometimes the responsibility of being a public records custodian, as required by the Louisiana public records law, requires work. And in this case, particularly because of the controversy surrounding these DA subpoenas, I'm sorry they had to spend that money, but that's what the law requires.
Scott Sternberg, attorney for the Lens, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll be back next week with a new edition of Behind the Lens. We put the podcast online on Friday afternoons, and you can listen on our website, on Apple Podcasts, on Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher. So listen where and when you can. And if you like it, please share it on Twitter, Facebook, whatever you like. Your generous support makes our reporting possible. So please give a donation today at support.thelensnola.org. I'm Tom Wright. Thank you for getting Behind the Lens.